Hi, welcome to USA Fencing Coaching Education Podcast. I'm Sam Callen, your host. While the podcast is geared to coaches, I think many folks will find the topics of interest. Guests on the podcast will be fencers, coaches, club owners, and also for people from outside the fencing world who can contribute to improving coaching. If you have suggestions for a podcast topic or guest, please email me at s.callen@usafencing.org. That's s.callen@usafencing.org. Thanks, and enjoy the day's episode. Hey, welcome to today's podcast where I interviewed 2016 Olympian Kat Holmes. Kat grew up in the Washington, D.C. area and played a bunch of different sports. She got into fencing because she was an avid reader, and the book she was reading featured a lot of sword battles and fencing type of things, and she wanted to get involved in that and give it a try, and she found a fencing club nearby, and her parents were supportive of her giving fencing a go. And we talked a little bit about how it captivated her like no other sport had. We also talked a little bit about what she's currently doing and working in neuroscience and on brain concussion types of activities, so stuff that's very much in the news right now. And we talked about how her family supported her along the way as she came up through the ranks as a fencer and eventually becoming an Olympian. We also discuss, Kat does a great job of talking about how she likes to be coached or how she is accessible to coaching. And I think that's a really cool way of looking at it, that she really is open to being coached. And we talk a little bit about also how she likes to be coached during bouts themselves when your time is very limited. And there's probably a lot of information to be put on there. I really like that she talked about how her coaches took what she was doing and just tried to make it better rather than kind of forcing a style upon her. We discussed the importance of good communication between the coach and the athlete. And also we discussed her balancing academics with pursuing the Olympics. Kat is a graduate of Princeton University, so, you know, she wasn't skating by, especially not neuroscience. And one of those things, too, about her parents' influence and how they were kind of willing to adjust as things went along as new opportunities arose. So with that, I hope you enjoy this interview with 2016 Olympian Kat Holmes. Hey, welcome to the USA Fencing Coaching Podcast. It's a great pleasure to be joined today by Kat Holmes, who was on our 2016 Olympic team at FA. And Kat, thanks for joining me on the call.
Yeah, no problem. Glad to be here.
Great. Hey, let's start with a little bit about your background, like such as where'd you grow up, and maybe talk a little bit also how you got into fencing.
Yeah, so I grew up in Washington, D.C., home club, Chevy Chase Fencing Club, though I also fenced a bit at D.C. Fencers Club. And as a kid, like, I played a bunch of sports. You know, I played soccer, basketball, tennis, I swam, I kind of did the whole gambit. But I was also, like, a big nerd, and I loved reading books about medieval times and sword fighting, and I really wanted to sword fight, and I told my parents, you know, I want to sword fight, I want to fence, and they were like, oh, sure, whatever, what's one more sport? So I kind of Googled fencing in the area, and Chevy Chase Fencing Club was, you know, like about 10 minutes from my house, and, you know, there were classes once a week, part of the D.C. Parks and Rec program, so they were like, sure, go for it. And I just loved it. You know, I wasn't particularly good at it at first, but I just loved it. There was something about it that kind of captivated me the way that other sports hadn't, and so I just started doing it more and more. And then, you know, the more you practice, they found, the better you get. So it kind of went hand in hand. And then, you know, here I am today.
Wow. Great. I'll say that in doing a little digging around, just looking for articles and little tidbits about you, I saw a headline of an article that was described you. I'm probably not exactly quoting this right, but it's like DC swashbuckling surgeon. I thought that was really good. Yeah. So on that one, which brings me to, what are you doing now? And we'll kind of come back to where – we'll come back in between your childhood and what you're doing now as we go through this. But tell folks a little bit about what you're up to now.
Yeah, so right now I work at the Princeton Neuroscience Institute. I'm currently working in two different labs. The main lab that I'm working at now looks for biological correlates of concussive injury. So basically, we're trying to find a better way to diagnose concussions, because right now we, you know, there's a lot of studies and it's kind of like a hot topic, but we don't actually know a lot about the nature of the concussive injury, and we have a very poor procedure for diagnosing and tracking recovery. And so right now we're trying to find a better way than simply asking, you know, does your head hurt? Like, can you repeat these four words to me? So that's kind of one of the labs that I'm working in. And then the other lab does a computational modeling of human decision making, where we write, I primarily write reinforcement learning models, to kind of model how and why people around us learn, values, for certain things, and then why, they make certain decisions based off of those values.
All right. Well, the first one certainly is one of the hottest topics right now in youth sports.
Oh, yeah.
And I talked to a lot of colleagues with that, as well as adult sports, too. But, you know, we tend to have a soft spot for the youth for sure. And the second one, the decision-making one, is a fascinating area on that. You know, knowing, being a psychology major, you know, I kind of tune in, although I was never into the neurosciences like you are. I was more dealing with behaviors and rats and things like that.
Yeah.
So with that, but that's pretty cool. Good. All right, so you talked about a little bit about getting the fencing, and which is seems to be a common thing in talking with other people. They, you know, either saw a movie that had sword fighting in it and loved it, and, you know, parents did that. So what were, so you kind of enjoyed doing that. What about your, what about family and the social aspect of fencing? How, what kind of role did they play? And I met your mom. Your mom is on the board at this time for everybody who doesn't know that. And so it really became a family affair, it sounds like.
Yeah, and actually, you know, neither of my parents had ever fenced or ever really known a fencer. You know, my dad had actually coached a lot of my other, you know, kids' teams that didn't know anything about fencing. It was very much my thing kind of from the beginning that, you know, I pushed, you know, I wanted to fence. I wanted to fence more than anything else in the world, kind of. Like, you know, my parents always, you know, emphasized that, like, academics, you know, come first. So, like, if I didn't get my homework done, or, like, I didn't get a good grade on a test, like, I didn't get my computer or phone taken away, I was like, no, you can't go to fencing practice. But slowly, you know, over the years, as I've, you know, done this for a while, you know, my whole family has, you know, become very involved. I mean, I couldn't have gotten to where I am, you know, without them. You know, they've supported me the whole way. I mean, they've come to, you know, everything from, like, the local competition to the Olympic Games. They've always been there, and been supportive. And then my mom, I think she's going into her fourth year of being on the board. You know, she wanted to get more involved kind of on the other end, and kind of, you know, really help USA Fencing kind of grow to its fullest potential. So she ran and got elected to the board. And has really enjoyed that experience kind of working, to help, like, you know, grow and develop USA Fencing.
Yeah, and she's really good. I just was in my first board meeting as a USA Fencing employee, and I enjoyed getting to know your mom, during the meeting and during some of the breaks we had as well, with that. One of the, you know, you talked about getting involved in the club and, you know, I find it interesting that, you know, you know, just showing my age, and I've talked to some older Olympians and folks from the 60s and whatnot, and none of them Googled it to find out where the local fencing club was. So I found that one kind of humorous with that. But once you got to the club, tell me about some of the coaches and what they did to help you both develop, but also to, you know, to keep that passion for the sport going.
Yeah, so my first two coaches were Ray and Gene Finkelman. You know, I worked with Gene when I was younger, and then began to work more with Ray when I was older. And, you know, Chevy Chase, it's definitely a very small club. You know, we have a little room in a community center. We set up the strips every time. You know, we take them down every time. But it was a very, like, family-like environment because we were so small. And, you know, my best friends all throughout high school were always fencers, you know, first at the club and then kind of, you know, once I started going to tournaments, you know, fencers kind of in the region and then national and then international. So it kind of, you know, became in a way of like a second family for me and also my primary friend group. And Ray and Gene, they're, you know, I can't thank them enough for kind of everything they did, but it, for me, but especially, you know, I have a very distinctive fencing style. You know, I fence with my arm very, very extended. An epic fencer, who does that, not, you know, a lot of coaches when I was younger were like, you know, you maybe want to pull your arm in, like, that's, you know, you're tall. So maybe it's working in Y12, but maybe not Y14, cadet, et cetera, et cetera. And ranging, they, you know, they were like, no, like, this is how you fence. Like, and they really worked with me and my, you know, my natural abilities, meaning the abilities that I have and the abilities that maybe I had to work more to get. They said, okay, like, this is who you are. Let's work with that and really develop the best qualities in you. And so, you know, it's a very positive, very, you know, loving atmosphere, that, you know, really, really drew me into the sport, and made me love it.
So it sounds like they took what you were already doing, what you felt comfortable with, and just tried to make that better rather than you conforming to some sort of style that they had preset in their mind.
Yeah, well, I mean, as a very tall 10-year-old girl, you know, they always tell you, like, extend before you lunge. And I was, like, tired of extending before I lunge. So I was like, well, if I just extend all the time, my arm is always out there, so I don't have to extend before I lunge. And if my arm is always extended, like, I can just hit people because it's already there. So conceptually, it made sense to my 10-year-old self. And, you know, my coaches saw that, and they were like, okay, let's work with it.
Yeah. So how do you like to be coached?
You know, over the years, I've had the fortune to work with many, many different coaches, you know, from, you know, all over. And I think that you can really gain valuable pieces of knowledge from anybody. So I would say that there isn't one particular way that I like to be coached. I mean, obviously, I feel most comfortable when, you know, my coach is, you know, at the strip because we work together, you know, all day, every day. And we, you know, kind of have like an unspoken language. So the communication flows much more readily. But I think that it's not so much how do I like to be coached, but how do I accept coaching? Because I really try to keep an open mind and kind of look for those pieces of knowledge, those gems of information wherever they can be found.
Oh, I like the way you frame that of how you accept being coached. That's an awesome way to look at it, and I'm going to steal that from here on out. So much better than how I phrased it. With that, but I think that's a lot of self-awareness on your part, which is really good.
Thank you.
Let me ask you a really specific coaching question here about this.
Sure.
So you're in about, you get the 1 minute break. How do you like to be coached during that 1 minute? Boom, you got 60 seconds. The coach is going to come over. How is it you like that coach to deliver information, or what kind of information are you looking for, or how it's delivered during that quick time?
Well, generally, when we first start talking, like, the first thing I do is I say, okay, here's what I find is working. Here's what I find isn't working. Here's what I know I need to do. And so, like, I kind of, like, I'm like, blah, 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 and, like, all that's coming out of my mouth. And then, you know, whether it's, you know, my coach at home, or whether it's, you know, the national coach, they say, yes, yes, like, work on that. That's exactly the right idea. And then there's kind of just a lot of, like, head nodding. I do a lot of head nodding. And then, like, I always like to make eye contact. Like, okay. I just make eye contact and kind of, like, head nod. And then inevitably the coach will forget my water bottle, and I always have to point and grab my water bottle, because then I spend about 40 seconds just, like, drinking to try to, you know, like, quench that thirst. But, yeah, so it's just mainly, like, stating, you know, how I think things are going, and then kind of the coach filling in on that. You know, of course, occasionally I'm like, I don't know. Like, you gotta help me out here. But, like, you know, always, like, things in the positive, like, you know, you should work on this, you should work on that. Like, I don't love being told, like, well, don't do this and don't do that, because, okay, like, that's great, but I need to know what I can do to actually affect change in the next period.
Yeah. Too often the coaches and across the board, and this is generic to all sports, are very much like, well, you can't do this or stop doing that. It's like, well, then, okay, if I'm stop doing that, then what am I supposed to do in its place? And people don't oftentimes do that. So I like the way you frame that of, you know, tell me what I can do. And I really appreciate the fact that your coaches sort of let you come out with what you're observing first. And you know, I think that's a good lesson even for, you know, coaches of young kids who aren't experienced as you are to ask them, hey, what do you think is going on first? And let them start to think about and learn that process as they go along as well.
Probably brings
that lesson a lot better.
Yeah, kind of on that line, I think it's really important to have an open dialogue with whatever coach you're working with. My coach that I work with on a daily basis, you know, we talk about things all the time. Like lessons are kind of like, you know, they're very experimental. You know, we're working on this. We're going to say, I don't like this. Like, I don't feel like this action is something I'm going to and kind of incorporate in my fencing. And sometimes he says, yeah, you're right. Throw it out. Don't worry about it. And other times, you know, he's like, no, like, I really think that, you know, you don't like it now, but you might. I am constantly giving feedback on like how I feel like my fencing is going, what I need to work on, where are the holes in my game. And then, you know, with whatever coach I'm working with or whatever tournament, just being really honest and saying, you know, these are sometimes mistakes I tend to make, you know, you can look out for. Here are some key words that, you know, I really like to hear, or reminders that I find very helpful. So I think that having that open dialogue and being really open and honest about what you need and what you want, not only helps you, but also helps whatever coach you're working with, you know, really help you to the best of your ability.
Yeah. And I would encourage coaches to, you know, to make sure that is clearly communicated to the athlete, that it's okay to do that as well, and that permission to do that, if you will, and that the coach takes that understanding that you're trying to get better and doing that. That's a way of doing that.
Yeah.
Right. Kat, so moving on into when did you first start to think or first start to dream about the Olympics and then start to think this could really happen?
Yeah. So when I was 15, I made my first Cadet World Championship team, and I took second at Cadet Worlds. And, you know, I'd been to like two Cadet European circuits before that, and I'd done reasonably well. You know, finishing second at you know, a big event like that, I was like, wow, like, you know, maybe this is something that in the Olympics, you know, albeit they're very, very far off, like maybe it's like a real possibility and not just kind of like a little like pipe dream. Cause, you know, I remember watching, I think the first Olympics I remember was Salt Lake City in 2002. I remember watching all the athletes march in and kind of being like, who are these people, these like magical mythical creatures that like qualified to the Olympics? Like that would be really cool, you know. I was a little 9-year-old. I was like, yeah, like let's go like play Olympics in the backyard. And then, you know, at 15, maybe I was like, I started thinking, you know, maybe this is something that, you know, is actually a real possibility. And then in 2013, I made my first senior world championship team. And I knew then that, you know, it was definitely something that was, it was possible. And so I said, okay, you know, I just finished my sophomore year, in Princeton. And I said, okay, you know, I'm going to go to school for one more year. And then I'm really going to take 2 years, take 2 years off from school. I'm going to give it everything I have, because this is the type of thing that is going to require that.
Wow. And did you do that? Was that the plan?
I did. Yeah. So I took 2 years off. I was debating whether, so since I completed my junior year and then was going to take 2 years off between my junior and senior year, I debated whether, well, should I just graduate and then I'd still have a whole year. But, you know, at Princeton, you have a senior thesis that you have to write, which is especially in neuroscience, like a very intensive research project. So you have your thesis and you have your classes. And then, you know, I'm pre-med, so I'd be studying for the MCATs, you know, doing all of those things at once and then trying to qualify for the Olympics. I mean, I can say it now, like having completed my senior year without the added pressure of qualifying for the Olympics, like it would have been too much. And, you know, my parents always reinforced from a very early age that, you know, yes, fencing, you know, it's taken me very far and I love it, but academics are super, super important. And I didn't want to give, you know, a half heart to either my academics or to making the Olympics, because, you know, those are two things that really kind of deserve, you know, a huge amount of effort and a huge amount of intention. And so I said, you know, no, I'm going to take these 2 years. And I'm going to do it right. And that first year really was a lot of figuring out, you know, how does one train for the Olympics? Cause there's not really like a how-to manual. So it kind of took me a year to figure out, like, you know, how do I train? How do I eat? How do I, you know, sleep? You know, all putting all of the pieces together so that by the time Olympic qualifications started, I felt really ready and really prepared to kind of go down that road.
Yeah, that's amazing. I can sense parents listening to this going, oh my God, no, don't let my kids hear that she took time off from college. But it's okay. Ugh. You went back and finished. That's the key part, which,
well, you know, my mom,
someone at that level is going to finish what they start. So
My parents, you know, they always said, like, you're never going to play a sport in college because it'll detract from your studies. And then, you know, coaches started recruiting me and they were like, okay, you can play a sport in college. But they were like, you're never going to take time off from school to fence. Like, you're going to go right through, you know, and then, but then, you know, the Olympics kind of seemed like a real thing and they were like, well, okay, fine. But like, this is it. Like, you know, you go to the Olympics and, you know, apply to med school. But then, you know, we're so close to reaching the medal rounds in Rio.
Yeah.
And like, our team really felt like, you know, if we give it another quad that we could really do something in Tokyo. And they're like, okay, like, yeah, go for it.
Well, I love it, and I can totally I appreciate your mom even more now in doing that, because it's a very short window for this. And most people, well, I mean, let's face it, most people never make an Olympic team. But even people who make it only are able to do it one time, either because it's just really, really hard to get back there, or, you know, the dedication that requires and giving up lots of other things in your life, you know, it just doesn't happen. So I can appreciate that, trying to take advantage of that very narrow window of opportunity that you have.
Yeah, well, when I was considering, especially considering to, you know, put off applying to med school for, you know, a second time, you know, I thought, you know, I have the rest of my life to, you know, go to med school, to be a doctor, to practice medicine, but I can't turn around when I'm 50 and say, I'm going to give the Olympics another chance. And yeah. I would always wonder what if, and that would bother me more than anything for the rest of my life. So it is kind of weird now that, like, all my friends have graduated and have, like, these real people jobs. Like, some of them are in med school, you know, they're kind of progressing along that more traditional path. But, you know, I've committed to myself that no, like, I am going to go to med school. I'm not taking a traditional path, but I'm doing what I need to do. I'm doing what I was meant to do. And I don't have any questions in my mind that I should be doing something else right now.
Well, I know one success story that follows similar path to yours, and it's an old name from the past, and the older folks listening to this will know the name, perhaps, Eric Heiden, who was Olympian in 1980 and speed skating, and went on to a professional bike career after that, and then went to medical school, and he got a very successful orthopedic practice in Park City, Utah. So there's a model out there that, you know, for you to follow in that regard. So it can be done with that. So you mentioned the qualifying window for the Olympics. I want to kind of touch on that a little bit, because I think this is an area people probably don't understand very well, is How do you make the Olympic team in fencing in the United States? And keep in mind, this varies from sport to sport within the U.S. For sure. Maybe shortly or briefly describe that process.
Yeah. So in Rio, in women's epee, there was a team event. I mean, we'll have all of the team events in Tokyo. So this is applicable for all the weapons going forward. But essentially, the first step is to qualify the team, the U.S. team, to the Olympic Games. So they have a world ranking. FIE has a world ranking of the teams. And the top four teams in the world, at the end of qualification. So qualification starts in May and goes through the following April. So May 2015 to April 2016. And in April 2016, the top four ranked teams automatically qualify to the games. And then the top team in each zone, so North and South America, we call it Pan Am, that's our zone, Europe, Asia, and Africa, the top ranked teams in each of those zones will then qualify to the games. So USA was the top ranked team in the Pan American zone in women's FA, so we qualified that team. So then once you qualify the team within the United States, you then qualify the individuals to that team. So we have a very similar qualification system, starting in May and going in 2015 and going through April of 2016, where, you know, you fence all the World Cups, all the NACs, et cetera, et cetera. And at the end of qualification, the top three athletes in the country, will qualify to fence the individual event and the team event. And then the fourth ranked individual in the country will then qualify as the alternate to the team event.
Mm-hmm. No, very good. And it, just so folks know, it is conceivable that you could be one of those people who is going to all the World Cups and qualifying as a team, but then it could turn out in the very end, you might end up being that fifth ranked person and not going at all. So
it, yeah, it's that's a little, happened in a couple instances, yeah.
Yeah, it's happened in a lot of other sports as well. It's not an uncommon thing for that to happen. And so it is about qualifying spots. And in fact, just a little kind of behind the scenes thing. In some sports, in individual sports, you qualify spots and then you have to make the team in that spot. You're not even guaranteed, even though you go and get all the points. So some little behind, sort of inside baseball sort of thing there to mix my sports metaphors. Your Olympic experience, you're in Rio. What is something either competition wise or outside of competition that you think just sticks with you and will stick with you for the rest of your life about that experience?
I remember a lot of people, you know, beforehand telling me, you know, you've been to world championships, you've been to, you know, world university games, you've been to Pan Am games, but you've never been to anything like the Olympics. Like, when you walk out onto the Olympic stage, like, there's nothing quite like that. And I remember, you know, thinking like, oh, like, super nervous, like, just everybody there. But when I walked out, you know, when they called my name, you know, to fence my, you know, my first bout, you know, at the games, I wasn't nervous. I was very calm. And I remember thinking that, you know, I'd done everything I could to prepare. That's not to say that, you know, going for these next games, I'm not changing things, but at that point in time, I had done everything I could. You know, every facet of my training, from, you know, physical fitness to my diet to my psychology, like I was as prepared as I could be. And I remember thinking, like, if I let myself get nervous now, I'm only going to detract from all of the work that I've done to get myself to this point. So I wasn't nervous. I was like, there's no point, because I'm as ready as I'm going to be. And then one could make the argument, well, you know, if, you know, and I did end up losing my first bout. I lost it in overtime. And, you know, it's on the one hand, it's kind of painful knowing that, like, I put my best self out there and my best self lost. But it'd be more painful losing and thinking, well, what if I'd done this and what if I'd done that? Because I would have always wondered, you know, if I'd done something more, maybe if, what if? And, you know, as I said earlier, I hate that if. And I don't have an if now. Like, I did everything I could. And so, you know, I wasn't nervous. And while I was disappointed up there, and I knew then that, you know, there aren't mythical creatures in the Olympics. It's, you know, everybody that you see at every other World Cup, and, you know, the kind of that mysticism, that shroud was kind of taken down. And, you know, going forward, like, you know, I know that, you know, individually and as a team, that I and we can really do it.
Yeah, I think that's having confidence and preparation is so important for whatever level you're at, whether it's a local event that I'm confident I've done what I need to do to get in here, you know, always learning lessons along the way, but having that confidence that you're prepared to go in there. And then some days it just doesn't go your way. I mean, I don't mean to be flippant about that, but sometimes that person on that day is just better than you, calls maybe don't go your way, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah.
On that as well, which, well, don't need to bring up, right? On that one. That. What about sort of outside of the competition venue? What's the memories you have from, being at the games in that environment? Cause it's, and I've heard from other people and, that it is, you know, it is very different because you've got this much bigger stage. There are a lot more press things going on and you've got this Botswana and, you know, javelin thrower over here that is kind of eating dinner at the next table to you. So maybe a little bit of those experiences outside the competition itself.
Yeah, I mean, one of the most interesting experiences was just the dining hall. And kind of seeing, it's kind of like the watering hole for all the athletes. You know, you see all these athletes from like the giant volleyball players who are like, you know, 12 feet tall, these like massive dudes, to the teeny, teeny, tiny little gymnasts who, by the way, like I'm convinced that the Chinese gymnastics team only eats pineapple. Every time I saw them, they just had like trays loaded with pineapple. I was like, what is in that? That they, like, what is the secret? But just like, what? And then like, you know, on that, like, I just remember watching like the Polish men's volleyball team. Like they each had like four trays just like loaded with everything from like, you know, big cuts of meat to like piles of dessert, and you're just like, oh my god! Like, they just operate like on a different level of eating. It's just it's just super interesting, just kind of like people watching in that place, and you're seeing, yeah. And you know, everybody that's there is the best in their sport, and seeing what that entails in terms of like body types, because like a gymnast, yeah. You know, is not going to have you know, the same body type as a swimmer. So it's super right. Interesting just seeing how people's bodies are so sport specialized also. Yeah. And then you put, you know, 10,000 athletes, you know, in like a relatively small enclosed space. And all of these athletes have been training, you know, for years and years and years for this event. I mean, in sports, it's like the pinnacle of, you know, most sports events every 4 years. So at the beginning of the games, like, everybody's super focused, everybody's super serious. But then as kind of events start to finish, then there's this huge collective release. And because everybody there, like, you know, my mom, my coach, you know, my friends, they all saw me going through everything I did to qualify for the Olympics, but they themselves didn't go through it. And it's those people that have gone through it, you know, whether they're a Latvian speed walker, or as you said, like, you know, a Botswanan pole vaulter, you know, it's just they understand what it takes, that just like, you know, grinding through that pressure. And so when there is that collective release, it doesn't matter where people are from or if they speak the same language, like everybody's just hanging out and having a good time. And it was the most fun I have ever had.
That's very cool. Yeah, people, different sports, they understand the grind, they understand the long plane flights you took and the,
yeah.
And you know, giving up other things in your life while all your friends were going out and, you know, going to movies or going there, you said, well, man, I need to just sleep or rest or recover. And so there is that common bond, I think, amongst those. And you also, for the rest of your life, you are an Olympian. And, you know, well, that is a, you know, great thing to have in front of your name or after your name, depending on however they want to put that part of it with that. All right, so now let me kind of wrap this up with a last question for you. And maybe if you can, how do you think fencing and you know, sports in general, fencing specifically, has sort of helped you outside of that? I mean, with looking at academics and what you're doing now in your lab work or just in your day-to-day life, how has what you've learned or what you've gone through as a fencer helped you out in those areas?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of high school juniors and seniors that are looking at colleges, you know, when they're talking to me about, they often ask, you know, how does all the NCAA and then, like, you know, all the World Cup travel and that travel, how does it impact your studies? And I would just say, I think my grades were always better in season than out of season. You know, when I was my most busy, you know, I was my most studious, because you don't have time to waste. You know, as I've kind of mentioned in reference, you know, a couple of times, like, you know, academics are exceedingly important to me. And so, you know, because I was traveling, and practicing all the time from a young age, like I never had time to waste. So, you know, my parents set this rule, you know, you're going to get good grades, if you want to fence. So I was like, oh, I better get good grades. So I just, you know, I studied, you know, I had an hour here, an hour there. Planes are great. Like, you have no other distractions for, like, you know, 6 to 10 hours. It's awesome. You can get so much work done. And yeah, it's not the most fun thing to do, but when you only have a certain amount of time to accomplish something, you get it done. And I found that, you know, the busier I am, like, the more disciplined, I become. Mm-hmm. And so having such structure in my life and kind of seeing how, you know, sports is, it can give you a very concrete example of, you know, I lift this much weight on week one and then this much weight on week two. You can see the kind of physical increases and physical gains of doing something, in a disciplined, repetitive manner. It's the same in school. So you can really kind of apply the two systems, to each other. And then they really reinforce each other in terms of, well, I have this time, so I've got to do it now.
That's incredible. I think that's a good lesson to learn from folks, is not to waste that time. Take advantage of every moment that you have. And I've told people that with, you know, always have something that you can work on if you find yourself standing in line, or that you can, you know, read or catch up on. And so that you're not wasting that time standing in line at the DMV or whatever else it may be. So that time management part becomes really important. Good.
Yeah.
Well, I want to, thanks again for taking time away from your lab work. I sort of feel like, wow, am I slowing down the, you know, the progress in concussions by talking with you for about 45 minutes here. So I do appreciate that.
Yeah,
and,
no problem.
And I'm looking forward to seeing you at competitions. My first interaction with you ever in person was very delightful. You'd gotten the wrong size jacket, and it was blatantly obvious that it was the wrong size jacket. But you were very funny with bringing that to our attention. So anyway, so once again, Kat, I want to thank you. Thanks for taking time, and thanks for sharing your thoughts. And it's great to have, you know, somebody like you in the sport. I think you're a great model for others, you know, to follow.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me on the program.
Hey, this is your host, Sam Callen, once again, thanking you for joining us for today's podcast. Once again, if you have suggestions for topics or guests, please email me at s.callen, that's C-A-L-L-A-N, at usafencing.org. And I also want to thank Lee Rosevere. The music you hear on the intro and that I'm talking over right now is provided by Lee. He does that for podcasts for free. So if you're interested, please Google him. It's Lee, L-E-E, Rosevere, R-O-S-E-V-E-R-E. And join us for our next podcast. Thank you.